This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We talk to citizens who are most impacted by the latest scratch-your-head federal policies and bring you the most interesting guests we can find. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Here, we're grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we're talking with award-winning writer of espionage and science, Yudhijit Bhattacharjee, and Dr. Casey Keeler, expert on American Indian housing policy in the mid-20th century, and member of the Potawatomi tribe, and Karen Wood, who was scheduled to be here, cannot be here today, so we're sorry about that. She was a member, or she still is a member of the Monica Nation. Perhaps we'll have her back another time. Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. And you know who else is here?
Who's here?
Sorry, it's not a pop quiz. I was going to tell you anyway. 24 million Americans who still have their health insurance, despite what was tried yesterday, after all of the protests and the rallies and the postcards and the phone calls and the letters and all those town halls, they actually mattered, and they could not repeal or replace Obamacare yesterday. I am shocked,
I know,
frankly.
I'm so happy. I heard that some of the organizations that were against, there were hundreds against it. Some were the American Hospital Association, the American Nursing Association, AARP, to name a few, and not to mention, I think it was going to affect rural people ages like 54 to, I don't know, 80 or something the most.
Right. All the people
negatively.
That they always say voted for him. I know. It was so mean-spirited and so hard-hearted. And I think, you know, Trump and Ryan were the best spokespeople to kill it, frankly.
Yeah.
So, and because of that, I just, I did want to shout out to our two guests that were from Indivisible Charlottesville, Ken Horn and Leanne Fox. Obviously, we're grateful to their work and everyone else who did their part.
Yes.
Just amazing. Anyway, so that's what I have. What do you have? What do you got?
I was going to talk about that a little, too. I was just going to say, luckily, Republican Care, the vote didn't happen and it failed, which you already talked about. I was going to say that our ranking, according to the United Nations, the U.S. ranking, we've now moved down in the happiness list. And no one can, in other words, the U.N. report came out with who are the top, 30 happiest nations. And Norway is the happiest place, according to that report. And I was not surprised to see that we dropped.
Why were you not surprised?
That we're not.
You tell. What's been going on?
Oh, have you been listening to the news lately? Yeah, so apparently all we need are some reindeer and some fjords, and we'll be with Norway.
Yeah.
Also, something interesting that I noted was that some Democratic members of Congress wanted to do something called the Mar-a-Lago Act. Have you heard of that?
No. I think I have, but please, you.
I think it's a real thing, although there's probably no chance it will happen because of the Republican-controlled Congress. But it is Making Access Records Available to Lead American Government Openness Act. Leave it to them to have a long name. But it's basically to require the publication of White House visitor logs. It was done regularly by Obama, but since Trump took office, it would be a mandate to release the visitor log so we can see who he conducts business with, for example, at Mar-a-Lago.
Right. That I didn't realize it was focusing on stuff like that. I actually thought it was more about him not being able to go there and do secret things, but the detail, anyway, the details that you mentioned are, yeah, I would love for that to see the light of day. It's a great idea, actually.
Yeah.
I think he's there right now, as usual. if it's the weekend, he's there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, speaking of Indivisible, may I tell you something else that they're doing?
Yes.
So
save the world, please.
Yeah, let's save the world. It's also, they're actually joining forces, to be fair, with UVA Democrats and some student organizations They are holding a nonpartisan democracy festival and rally as a forum for those disappointed here in town by Representative Garrett's refusal to meet with constituents in an inclusive, transparent setting. He's having his own little shindig for like five people or something. And so this is a Let's Talk Tom at 5 o'clock, March 31st. I think that's Friday.
I shouldn't step on that. You want to say it again? I'm sorry.
Friday, March 31st at 5 o'clock on the South Lawn at UVA. That's when that rally's happening, because since we can't get into Tom's little shindig, we're going to have our own.
Gotcha. Is this the sort of thing where they will, like, put the milk cartons out and they're going to, have you seen this man sort of thing?
Yeah.
Are they going all out with it? You know,
missing,
to make sure?
Probably, yeah. And then Tuesday before that, this week, March 28th at 6:30, Surge is having a newcomer's orientation at Thomas Jefferson Memorial Church. That's showing up for racial justice.
You know, it's so much like Obama once, you know, said often. Actually, it's just been a while and I miss the guy, but, you know, it's, you are the change. I mean, that is just, how else to, you know, explain what happened yesterday? And I know they're going to do all they can, the Republicans, to chew at it in different ways, but nonetheless, this was like a layup yesterday. They were just, the House is riddled with Republicans, you know, and they couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just amazing.
They couldn't do it because apparently passing health reform is complicated.
Yeah, and only like 9%, I think, strongly supported it. 9, you know.
Mm. Wow. Well, it was a happy day, happy moment.
Yep.
So we have an amazing show today, Nancy.
Please do tell. I repeat myself.
Yes, our first guest is Udigit Bhattacharjee. He is an award-winning writer whose features and essays on espionage, cybercrime, science, and medicine have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, Wired, and others. So welcome, Udigit.
Thank you, Ellen. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, well, I should say welcome to Charlottesville. You're here for the Virginia Festival of the Book, and it's for the book The Spy Who Couldn't Spell, A Dyslexic Traitor, An Unbreakable Code, and the FBI's Hunt for America's Stolen Secrets.
That's right. I am delighted to be here. I had a great session yesterday, and it's a beautiful town, and also it's a great food town, I'm discovering.
what did you have?
Well, we went to this Italian place called Tavola.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it was fantastic. I could go on about it, but I'll just tell you that I
write
had a great...
book about it, and we'll have you back, and then we'll have an excuse to discuss food for a change.
It really was delightful. I'm here with my family, with my two kids and my wife, and we really enjoyed it.
Yes. And you're from the Maryland area?
Yes. I live in the Republic of Tacoma Park.
It's a republic. Well, we're in a commonwealth.
Well, it's a nuclear-free zone. You know, it's one of the few towns that actually has a law on the books that sort of prohibits any nuclear materials.
Wow. Can I move? When can I go?
You're welcome anytime. Judging by your show, you'd be welcomed with open arms.
Oh, fantastic. So before we delve into the story that you wrote about, who is this spy? Who is he? Brian Regan.
So the spy who couldn't spell is how Brian Regan was referred to. Brian Regan was a signals analyst who worked for one of the most secretive of the intel agencies that the United States has. It was the National Reconnaissance Office, which is a multi-billion dollar agency that manages all of the spy satellites that give the United States a tremendous technological edge in the military world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where he worked. You know, he had been in the Air Force since 1980, but his story, the story of his espionage, really took place when he was at the NRO in the late 1990s.
And the NRO is what, sir?
Yeah, so the NRO is an agency just like the CIA, like the NSA. It's an agency that sort of helps to develop and then put into orbit these secret spy satellites that collect both signals intelligence and photographic intelligence from space. So these are the images that help the military sort of develop battle plans and defend the United States and its allies.
Why is that one less known to the public? Or is that my perception only?
No, you are absolutely right. In fact, until 1992, even the existence of the NRO was classified. So nobody in the public knew that such an agency existed, but it had been set up in the late 1950s. I think it dates back to 1960, and it was started jointly by the Air Force and the CIA to develop satellites to do photo reconnaissance and signals reconnaissance. And because it was so sensitive at the time and continues to be, the Pentagon decided that it should be completely kept a secret. That's why people have heard about the CIA, they've heard about the NSA, and of course, you know, they hear about other intelligences like the DIA, but they don't know that the NRO exists, or at least they didn't until 1992, when the government finally declassified its existence, and that's roughly when the story begins.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something, and we're talking with Udijit Bhattacharjee about his book and many other writings. So, well, one of the questions I have is how did this guy get clearance for such a, you know, top secret kind of
place. Brian Regan was, you know, he had been in the Air Force since 1980, and he was, you know, he was a very competent signals analyst, and he had served at various, military bases, Air Force bases around the world. In fact, he had, he had made a very significant contribution during the first Gulf War. In 1991, he was at the Pentagon then, and his signals analysis and his expertise was very helpful to military commanders. So he had clearance just because, you know, he had a job that required clearance, that required access to top secret classified information.
Mm-hmm. And tell us what he did. Tell us.
Yeah, so to summarize what he did, he was basically sort of a precursor to Manning and Snowden in collecting just tons of secret information. So what he did specifically was using his computer at the NRO, he downloaded and then printed out just tens of thousands of images and documents, most of which were top secret classified. And then he took these home with him. He put these documents bit by bit in his gym bag under his sort of dirty gym clothes, and then just walked out of the building day in and day out, and then amassed these documents in his basement, and then sorted them, and then he put them in Tupperware containers and garbage bags and took them out to two state parks outside of D.C., one in Virginia, the Pocahontas State Park, and another one in Maryland, the Patapsco Valley State Park. And he buried these secrets in about 19 different locations across these two state parks. And then he encrypted the coordinates of these hiding locations. He'd taken a GPS with him. He recorded the coordinates of each location. He converted that into a code. And so what he was left with in the end of this process was, you know, this gobbledygook that looked like gobbledygook if he had been, you know, if anybody had seen it, and they did. And his plan was to sell these secrets to the governments of Libya, Iraq, Iran, and China.
And why? What is the deal with him? Why did he want to do this in the first place? Sell these secrets as he.
Well, he so he was in severe debt. He was in great financial distress in the late 1990s when he was about 2 or 3 years away from his retirement from the Air Force. And Brian Regan, sort of being a bit of a loner, was very anxious. He didn't know that. He wasn't sure that he would get a job. He was uncertain about his future prospects once he left the Air Force. So that was sort of the superficial and sort of the immediate reason for his deciding that he was going to sell secrets to solve his problems. But he had a deeper psychological reason for doing what he did. He had grown up with severe dyslexia, hence the name The Spy Who Couldn't Spell. And because of his dyslexia and because of some of his personality traits, he had been ridiculed and humiliated, throughout his childhood. So in fact, when you talk about marginalized people, I think Brian Regan qualifies as somebody who was sort of on the margins in many ways. People thought that he was not very smart, and he kind of suffered as a result of this perception, even at his workplace, even though he was competent and he was able to do a good job, he always felt that he didn't get the respect that he deserved. In the book, I describe how he was made fun of, or how people took jabs at him. So. The deeper psychological reason was for him to show that he was smart. He wanted to validate himself. And so these two reasons sort of conspired to make him do what he did.
Was it tough for you to find out about him because he, too, is a spy? Just the nature of his job, did that make it even tougher for you to research what he did?
Right, that's a good question. So he was a spy, but he wasn't a spy who had been assigned spying duties by the government. So he's sort of different from a spy, as in somebody, an agent for the CIA. He was more of an analyst. So his own job for the intelligence community didn't involve spying per se, but it involved analyzing radio signals and other communications intercepts. But he was a spy in the sense that he was a traitor. He was attempting to spy against the United States by divulging American secrets to America's enemies.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to go to a break in just about 30 seconds, but quickly, how did you discover the story?
Well, in 2008, I was at the journal Science as a science writer, and I'd been covering the FBI's investigation of the anthrax letter attacks, and in the course of that, I came into contact with the director of the FBI lab in Quantico, who invited me to come and interview and perhaps profile a codebreaker there named Daniel Olson. And when I spoke to Olson, Olson described the various cases he'd worked on, and most of them involved, secret messages exchanged between prison gang members and so on. But then right at the end of his little talk, he told me about an espionage case, and it turned out to be one that hadn't really been written up. That's how I discovered it.
Thank you. We're talking with Udijit Bhattacharjee. He's a best-selling writer. He wrote The Spy Who Couldn't Spell. We'll talk more with him after this break. This is 94.7 WPVC. Welcome back. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos with your hosts, Ellen Daniels. That's me here in Charlottesville, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We're talking with best-selling writer Udijit Bhattacharjee, and then in a moment we're going to be talking to Dr. Casey Keeler, postdoc in Native American Studies at the University of Virginia. So Udijit, we were just chatting with you about how you discovered this story, which is pretty interesting, and you mentioned anthrax.
Yes. Well, anthrax was just, it's very tangential even to how I found the story, but yeah, it's... you know, it was because of my interest in science, and that's what led me to the story. And then once I learned about the code-breaking effort, because just to kind of finish up the story of the story itself, you know, so what Brian Regan did was he buried these documents, and then he tried to sell them to foreign governments. But even after he was caught, the FBI didn't know what he had stolen exactly and where he had hidden the materials. So they knew that that they had to recover all of these secrets. And that's where Daniel Olson, the code breaker that I was mentioning, comes in. He was tasked with decrypting the codes that had been recovered from Brian Regan. And he wasn't able to do it. It took the FBI 2 years to ultimately crack those codes and recover the stolen material. So this is a spy story where, you know, the search for the traitor sort of is only half the story, because even after the traitor is found, the case isn't resolved. You know, you have to read on to figure out how the government ultimately unravels Brian Regan's plot.
And how close did he get to selling U.S. intelligence to those to a foreign government? I know Libya was one of them. And anyway, how close did he get?
Well, he was very close because, you know, his he was able to steal the documents and he was able to hide them. And then he was making these attempts, repeat attempts, to market this information to the Libyans and the Iraqis and the Iranians. And he did, in fact, manage to, you know, walk into an embassy, a Libyan embassy in Europe and sort of make his offer. But because of his kind of social awkwardness and his lack of finesse, he wasn't taken seriously. But one assumes that if he had kept trying, he would have ultimately succeeded. So I think the FBI sort of intervened just at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Just not to geek out too much, but there's quite a lot that goes on with these codes, and they were really complicated, weren't they?
They were extremely complicated, and that's because Brian Regan sort of invented his own way of encrypting the coordinates. And in fact, the code that proved the most difficult to break, even after Brian Regan, you know, confessed to his crime at the end. I mean, he didn't confess. He was taken to trial and he was proved guilty. But once he realized that he no longer, you know, he would no longer be able to deny his crime, even after he cooperated, it was incredibly hard to resolve this code. And this involved pictures from his junior high school yearbook that he had used in a very complicated scheme to devise the code. You can read all about it in the book.
yeah, I saw a little bit. It's really
interesting. Ellen, you set him up perfectly. That is the best question you could have asked.
Indeed. Thank you, Ellen.
Yes, you're very welcome. It's the least I can do. And it does prove that he was not such a dumb person.
No, I think what's amazing about Brian Regan is that Regan was actually very talented and very smart, and he was just smart in ways that were not obvious to the people that he grew up with, the people that he worked with, and he just had this sort of inner cunning that he deployed in the service of his treasonous plot, and of course, you know, that was to his detriment in the end. But I sometimes wondered, while writing the story, how life would have turned out for him if his talents had been recognized early on, if he had gotten the respect that he felt he deserved, you know, if he had a few good friends who would have counseled him. I think he would not have gone down this road.
Were you at any point able to communicate with him?
I was not, unfortunately. I tried for many years, and the reason is that Brian Regan is one of a handful of federal prisoners who are under what's known as special administrative measures. These are, you know, these are sort of some strict terms of incarceration that prohibit him from speaking to anybody outside of his prison, apart from his family. And even though it's been more than 13 years, this is the 14th year since he was convicted and all the secrets were recovered, the government still will not lift the SAMs, that those prohibitions. And so it's, you know, it's people like the Boston bomber and other terrorists and spies who are sort of placed under this restriction. So what I managed to do was I managed to speak to some of his coworkers, his friends from childhood, in order to kind of understand his life story, and then I got a lot of material from speaking to the agents who debriefed him after all of the secrets were recovered, and so I benefited, and in the end I was able to collect enough material to bring Regan to life. Mm.
And how much did you struggle with the, you know, your ambition to write this story and also knowing that the FBI might be concerned about keeping methods secret or other, or secrets secret? You know, how did you deal with that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, I was just patient and persevering. and to be fair to the FBI, I mean, I received considerable cooperation from the Bureau. Because I think they were proud of this case. They were able to successfully prevent what would have been a catastrophic intelligence disaster, because the secrets that Regan was about to give away, even though I haven't seen them myself because, you know, I don't have the requisite clearances, but I know about the nature of them, and, you know, they would have been devastating, absolutely. So, there were certain times during the reporting of this book that I would ask questions that I didn't get clear answers to about, you know, methods employed. But in the end, if you read the book, you'll see that, that there's not much missing in terms of how the investigation took place.
Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to kick you out, but I think you have a book signing to go to.
Correct? I do, and I would I would urge all of your listeners to come to the Omni and buy some books.
All right, and the book again is The Spy Who Couldn't Spell, A Dyslexic Traitor, An Unbreakable Code, and the FBI's Hunt for America's Stolen Secrets. This is Udijit Bhattacharjee. Thank you so much
for being here.
Thank you so much, Nancy, and thank you, Ellen.
Thanks. We hope you'll stop by and test out more of our restaurants. We could talk about that sometime.
And thank you especially for doing such a good job with the pronunciation of my name.
Yes, you're very welcome. We really do try. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you.
Sure. Bye-bye.
And Nancy, I will say, I think you had a disaster of the week you might have wanted to talk about.
Yes, let's bring it back down again. Please, can we do that? Let me introduce.
Sure.
It's always time for a day's disaster. And my day's disaster goes to the White House. In their new budget, they want to zero out the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, which is an independent agency that monitors and studies catastrophes that have happened at natural gas sites and chemical plants and oil refineries. And so they want to zero out this oversight and put at risk Americans, you know, living near these places, and undo decades of study. What do you got, Ellen?
You've taken the breath out of me. That's horrible. Well, I just wanted to call attention to the two Russian people who have died mysteriously. One, a lawyer for a Russian whistleblower. Someone fell out the window mysteriously. Yeah. He was about to appear in court to defend this whistleblower. And then a former Russian parliamentarian who fled Russia last October, he was killed in the streets of Kiev, just shot. He was a criticizer of Putin's government.
Yeah, it's incredible what they do when they don't want someone to talk. And I wonder when Manafort ever winds up in front of Congress, if a piano is going to fall on that guy. You know what I mean?
You think he'll be a scapegoat for the whole?
Yeah. I don't know enough if it's him or Flynn. I don't know.
Exactly. Flynn.
Someone's going to get all Flynn. The mud.
We need an independent investigation, prosecution.
I am with you, sister.
Yes.
That's an excellent idea.
So, I would love to introduce our next guest. Are you up for it?
No, I'm done. Let's just wrap this up. Yes, no, please. I'm sorry.
She is patiently waiting for the introduction. No. She is the Native American Studies postdoctoral fellow at the University of Virginia. She's Dr. Casey Keeler. Her research examines American Indian suburbanization, American Indian housing policy, settler colonialism, and much more. She's an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation of Oklahoma and is also affiliated with the Tuolumne Miwok of California. Welcome, Casey.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, sure. I learned that UVA has never, ever had a postdoc in Native American Studies, and you're the first.
That is correct. So I am housed in the American Studies program at the University of Minnesota. In my position,
or Virginia.
Okay. I am housed. My PhD is from the University of Minnesota in American Studies, excuse me. But currently I'm housed at the American Studies program at the University of Virginia.
Yeah. And Minnesota has a soft spot in my heart, at least. I'm from Minnesota as well,
right,
which we have discussed. I don't know where Nancy's from.
It doesn't matter.
Okay, all right.
Please go back to the discussion.
Espionage. I don't know. You're so secretive. Okay.
No.
I'm sorry. Are you like the person to educate us about Native Americans, I think? What took UVA so long?
I'm not sure. And I think there's still quite an effort to make a position such as mine permanent. The classes that I've taught this so far, fall and spring semester, have turned out wonderfully. The students are very excited to learn. I've gotten lots of feedback about these sorts of classes. I know Karen Wood, who was supposed to be with us today, has taught in various capacities, particularly in anthropology. That's what her PhD is in. So there's very much an interest with students here at Virginia.
Mm-hmm. This is 94.7 WPVC. If you just tuned in, we're talking with Dr. Casey Keeler. She's a postdoc for Native American Studies. This is Resistance Radio, and you're listening to Apropos of Something. So there's so much to talk about in the little time that we have. I wonder if you, like, where do you start to talk to people? Maybe you could give us a little bit of a timeline for assuming that we really know nothing.
So what I usually do, for my students at least, is to talk about who is an American Indian. What does that term mean? And I find that's a good place to begin because it helps to explain the political, legal relationship between American Indian tribal nations and the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Great. So let's get into that a little bit.
So American Indian people are distinct from any other racial or ethnic group in the United States because of the political and legal relationship with the federal government, which comes from earlier relationships from colonizing countries like Spain, France, Britain, and the treaty making process that occurred with each of those nations. And then eventually with the founding of the United States, treaty making between the federal government and tribal nations. So that's distinct, setting American Indian people apart from other racial and ethnic groups because, again, of that political and legal relationship.
So they were considered a political entity.
Right.
Okay. And what were
sovereign nations.
Sovereign nations. Okay. And what did the treaties have to do with? Usually.
So early treaties, I would say, were based more on diplomacy and trade. And then as the United States was founded and became a settler colonial nation, treaties became more so about land acquisition, settlement, for non-native settlement. So clearing the land of native people and the creation of reservations to acquire native land.
And can you talk about how that was a tragic thing? I mean, let's hear the truth about what was going on there with those treaties.
Right. So most people have heard of the Trail of Tears, which is one of the most common examples, most frequently talked about examples of removal and land loss for Native people. So treaties often stipulated Native land cessions in exchange for monetary payments, trade goods, and often these treaties stipulated payment in perpetuity. So forever, the federal government was supposed to be providing X, Y, and Z, which is why we have things today like Indian education programs, Native health programs. They all go back to these treaties. And it's pretty clear that the federal government has never upheld their obligations in these treaties, which are legally binding documents. So, you know, payments were never fulfilled. They quickly ended. So when we think about the devastation of land loss, it's compounded by also poverty, isolation of reservation communities, and unfulfilled treaty obligations, thinking about education, what education systems on reservations look like, access to health care. And we can trace a lot of these contemporary issues to unfulfilled treaty obligations that date back hundreds of years in many cases.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of questions to talk about your research, but just to set just a little bit more groundwork. So the reservations and the treaty making was because the colonial people, the non-natives, were wanted, was like a land grab, right? And
right.
And so can you just talk a little bit about that and how, you know, how it was sold? And
right. So the United States is very much a settler colonial nation. With the founding of the United States, more and more immigrant peoples came to the United States and therefore required more and more land. So this kind of narrative of the frontier and free land, the United States is being discovered, really denies indigenous peoples' land claims. So treaties were a way for the federal government to acquire land for settlers. So as more and more land was needed, more and more treaties were negotiated, and Native people were essentially pushed further and further west. So when we think about reservations today, most of them are in the central part of the United States or in the western part of the United States.
And were they paid for the land?
They were supposed to be.
Okay. That's what you mentioned. Yeah, so they were paid nothing or very little.
Right, and there's also significant evidence that when treaties were negotiated between tribal nations, tribal leaders, and the federal government, that there was often swindle, deception, bribery, alcohol use. So they weren't, you know, really equal documents in the process.
Mm-hmm. We have a hard break coming up, so we'll come back and we'll speak with Dr. Casey Keeler some more. And we'll be back right after this. This is Ellen Daniels here with Nancy Lawrence. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Dr. Casey Keeler.
Hello.
I was curious, Dr. Keeler, you had written an article called Putting People Where They Belong, American Indian Housing Policy in the Mid-20th Century. It's the title itself sounds like someone determined someone's place. Is that what you meant? And even if you didn't, what was the article? Can you describe what you discovered in that in your research?
Yes. So my article, Putting People Where They Belong, which just came out in the Journal of Native American Indigenous Studies, examines the federal relocation program for American Indian people that came about in the post-World War II era. And I juxtapose that alongside the GI Bill of 1944, also in the post-war era. So I look at these two programs and how they are really designed for different people, and they moved these different groups of people to different, very different residential locations. So the GI Bill is responsible for the significant mass suburbanization movement in the post-war era. It provided funding, guaranteed housing loans to veterans returning from World War II, and the VA preferred new home construction in suburban areas over home renovations or new home construction in urban areas. So this is kind of where not only suburbanization in the post-war years comes from, but also the idea of white flight, leaving urban areas. So at the same time, the federal relocation program was underway in the post-war years, which sought to move American Indian people off of reservation lands to urban areas. And the idea behind this was it went hand in hand with the termination policy of the late 50s, early 60s as well, which was a way for the federal government to terminate this political legal status between the federal government and sovereign tribal nations. So the federal government was looking at relocation as a way to not only get Indian people off of reservations to urban areas, but then to terminate their status, and a way for the federal government to stop, again, providing guaranteed services to Native people on reservations. So essentially, once they were moved from reservation communities to urban areas, they were kind of just left on their own, and in many ways lost a lot of the programs and support for Native people that are on reservations only.
I had no idea of the second part of that. Wow, that is terrible.
Right.
Like, it wasn't terrible enough. I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
So when we think about the GI Bill and suburbanization, you know, new homes in suburban areas and home ownership and what home ownership means, and compare that to the relocation program where Indian people were going to urban areas, almost always in dilapidated short-term rental units. And when I say short-term, I mean 2 weeks, a month, you know, nothing long-term. So constant movement of Native people trying to find a place where they could live, where they were able to live because there was lots of racism at this time, and where they could afford to live. So lots of reports of overcrowding, you know, not running water, unsanitary conditions. So these sorts of living environments. So again, thinking about how relocation and the GI Bill were housing programs for people based on race, and to put them in very different locations. So suburbanization, white people moving out of cities, white flight, but then putting American Indian people in these areas where whites were moving out of.
And do you happen to know the GI Bill, which, you know, kicked off so much of this housing boom, how were the American Indian veterans, you know, what, how were they treated?
Right. So in the article, I use several case studies of American Indian veterans because I really want to highlight the discrepancy there and how difficult a process it was for American Indian veterans to navigate. So American Indians actually serve in the military in higher rates per capita than any other racial or ethnic group. So when it came to the GI Bill and American Indians, it was very problematic in this time period because, as my research points out, American Indian veterans were kind of told multiple things by multiple agencies. So the VA is separate from the BIA. The Veterans Affairs Administration often told Native veterans, well, you need to go to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We can't help you. You know, you're already entitled to these benefits from the BIA. But in reality, they were entitled to benefits from both the VA and the BIA. So in many ways, they are often misled, I would say, away from home ownership programs and to relocation programs.
Those relocation programs are the ones that you just described, where they get absolutely nothing and their status goes away, and the government sort of washes their hands of them, if I heard you right.
Correct.
Right?
So in my research, looking at archival documents from this time period, the 1950s and 60s, you know, I have found instances of Native veterans specifically writing to the BIA and the VA asking for help to obtain a home loan and being told by the VA, no, you need to go to the BIA, rather than offering them the help that they were entitled to as veterans.
What does your research actually entail for, you know, what kind of data are you in search of? Do you find it?
So when I looked at these relocation records maintained by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I was hoping to find this treasure trove of information about American Indians just moving into the suburbs, and that's absolutely not what I found. I found information about the relocation program and Native people being really directed towards the relocation program. So my research, I think about suburbs as historically Indian places, which logically makes sense. I don't think very many people think that in depth about place. So I look at the history of places and place names and indigenous inhabitants before settler colonialism. I look at Minnesota in particular, and Ellen and I talked about this briefly. So suburbs like Minnetonka Shakopee, Anoka, Wayzata, all come from Dakota and Ojibwe words, which are the native groups of that region, and how even with names coming directly from the native language, there's this disassociation between native people and suburbs. And instead, many think about American Indians as either exclusively on reservations or in urban areas. So my research tries to kind of break apart this binary and say, hey, suburbs really are historically Indian places. Why don't we think about American Indians in suburbs? And what is the history of American Indians' access to suburbs and home ownership throughout the 20th century? So looking at the history of housing policy, kind of beginning with the history of the Federal Housing Administration, kind of in the 1930s.
So does housing and suburbia, do they overlap in your view, or is it a cause and effect thing? Does one affect the other?
I think both. So okay. I look at Indian policy at the same time as I look at housing policy, and I look at how do these two things interact. So if we think about suburbs, again, as historically Indian places, and we know the history of treaties and the acquisition of Indian land, we must look at Indian policy and how the places that are suburbs today, how that land came to be acquired and developed. So, you know, the 1862 Homestead Act, which was a major way for the federal government to kind of sell Indian land to non-native settlers. So I think even today, you know, thinking about settler colonialism in action on the ground and what that looks like is important.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're talking with Dr. Casey Keeler. She is a Native American Studies postdoctoral fellow at the American Studies area at the University of Virginia.
I was also actually wondering, and maybe, anyway, how is the, you know, the Native American labor and migration movement, is that different before and after all of this relocation?
Both. So there was a lot of American Indian migration off of reservations in the 1920s and 30s, kind of after World War One, during the Great Depression years. There was mass migrations from the Dust Bowl region, you know, Oklahoma to California. Again, I look at Minnesota primarily for my research, so movement from American Indian people on reservations in the northern part of the state back down to the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And a lot of it was to do with work, right? American Indian people, just like other Americans at that time period, were in search of work. So migration was very much going on. We see a lot of migration during World War II. Again, World War II-related employment, also military service by Native people. And then again, in the post-war years, migration because of increased mobility, access to cars, highways, rail, and also because of this relocation program, it really hinged on job placement and job training, although that really fell short in addition to the housing aspect as well. So, right. You know, I think American Indian people, at least in the upper Midwest where I'm from, are really regarded as kind of around, their migration is regarded historically as around seasonal migrations based on the availability of resource. And I think that's what a lot of migration by Indian people today still relies on, is the availability of resource. But instead of it being, you know, the winter and what's available then and hunting, or summer and fishing, it's based on the availability of jobs and that movement back and forth from suburban or urban areas to reservations, or from different states across geographic regions, again, based on resources, in this case, employment.
Mm-hmm. Is that the scope of the book you're working on, the one American Indians and the American Dream, Suburban Indians, Policies and Property in Minnesota?
Right. So that the book that I'm currently researching kind of begins in this 1862 Homestead Act era, and it will end with very contemporary American Indian housing policy, looking at the American Indian Home Loan Program, which is the first and only off-reservation home ownership program for American Indian people in the United States, administered by the federal government. And that came about in the early 2000s. So I covered just over 100 years.
I was muttering something like that. Yeah, I'm sorry. I interrupted. Please.
I was just going to ask a broader question. How many Native Americans are in this continental U.S. right now?
That's a great question. roughly about 1.5 to 2% of the entire population of the United States identifies on census material as American Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a self-identification. So if you were to look at actual enrollment, tribal records enrollment, the number would be smaller because of the criteria that's used.
Mm-hmm. And that's the whole blood quantum
right
notion, which probably would be another show, I imagine.
Right.
But just a brief description of what that
absolutely.
Is.
So I said, you know, based on census material, about 1.5 to 2% of the United States population identifies as American Indian or Alaska Native, I should add. And that's self-identification. So, you know, on a census material, on a census form, you can identify as whatever you want. Nobody's checking. But that conflicts with actual numbers of enrolled tribal members. As sovereign nations, tribes have the ability to define their own membership criteria or enrollment criteria, and often that is based on blood quantum, which gets very murky because blood quantum comes from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So blood quantum was a way to, again, acquire more Indian land by setting a limit for what it is to be Indian. So the Dawes-Rolls is most commonly cited as the most frequent example of this kind of history of blood quantum. So the federal government kind of literally looked at Indian people. Agents of the federal government went around, looked at Indian people to create an enrollment log, the Dawes-Rolls, based often on just what you looked like. Obviously, there were major language barriers, culture barriers. There wasn't really this huge notion of blood, Indian blood. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. And how do you trace that? So, you know, you're either full blood Indian, half blood, quarter blood, maybe three quarters blood. So today we have all these really, really crazy fractions based on these census rolls that were taken, you know, in the mid 1800s about what it means to be Indian based on this perceived notion of Indian blood.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a way for the federal government to kind of regulate who would be Indian, knowing that if we insert these fractions, you know, eventually Indian people will just go away and then we don't have to worry about Indians and acquiring Indian land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. They manage both sides of the equation. They have no trouble, you know,
right.
Making it all work out perfectly.
And we're coming up at the end of the hour, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You'll have to come back. I just want to ask one burning question, which is just a quickie. How many Native Americans were here at the beginning before this stuff all started?
You know, there are estimates that range, you know, continent wide, including Central and Latin America, the United States, and Canada, you know, in the millions and millions.
Mm-hmm.
And then the low point of the American Indian population was like 1890s through 1910s, mm-hmm. and just a few hundred thousand.
Okay. So from like, I don't know, 10 to 50 million in the U.S., what's now the U.S., to
right.
like 3 million or 1 million. And it was below that, I believe.
Right.
Way below that before.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
At the turn of the 20th century was the low
wow.
point.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here, Dr. Casey
yeah.
Keeler.
Absolutely.
Native American Studies postdoc fellow at UVA right now. And we'd love for you to come back sometime.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ellen and Nancy, for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. You're doing great work, important work.
Thank you.
Nancy, how are you doing?
Oh, well, you know, I don't know how much lower my head can hang in shame, but other than that, fine.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I know you need to thank our guests and everything before I interrupt you at the end. So
I'm going to
shut up.
Just thanks to you, Digit Bhattacharjee, and Dr. Casey Keeler, and the Beckham team at Keller Williams for supporting our show and supporting the station.
Okay, then. So briefly, a palate cleanser from me is, it's actually a news thing, but it's a good one, in that after the White House fired the U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara for investigating Trump and all his connections to the Russian financial crime ring, the New York Attorney General went ahead and hired one of Bharara's team, this prosecutor, Howard Master, to essentially connect the same dots with Trump and his business practices in hopes of finding that he violated, you know, trying to show that he violated the Emoluments Clause. So my point is, you know, you fire one of these guys and they got, you know, and he instantly got hired by the New York Attorney General. What do you have?
Well, I want to report that the Maple Festival in Monterey was beautiful last weekend. Yes, it was great. Lots of maple syrup and things maple. And today it's going to be about 80 degrees. I think I may have the opportunity to play some tennis tomorrow, some drums. And I think that's it. And I do want to acknowledge our theme music from Springtide and 3540, 1800 from Japan. And I think next week we will guarantee that we will be apropos of something, as every week, Nancy.
A life certainty. I like it.
Yes. I'll talk to you next time, Nance.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at cbpodcast.com.